When we look with horror upon the travesty of ISIS, says author Karen Armstrong, we would be wise to acknowledge that its barbaric violence may be, at least in part, the offspring of policies guided by our disdain. Armstrong is discussing the toxic outcome of applying force to fundamentalist movements, helping them grow even more extreme. Listen in as Rabbi Katie Bowman, Associate Rabbi at Memphis Temple Israel, discusses extremism, its faults, limitations, and attractiveness, and how people of faith might seek to eradicate it. I'm the Reverend Richard Lawson, Rector of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, filling in for the Reverend Broderick Greer, and this is Theology Live at Alchemy in Memphis, Tennessee. And we have on this night, and this is a perfect guest as we address this topic, Rabbi Katie Bowman. Katie is the Associate Rabbi at Temple Israel. We are delighted you are here. This is Katie's first time to be at Theology Live, and welcome. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, Katie, tell me a little bit about yourself, your work at Temple Israel, and why you do what you do.
Well, I've been here in Memphis for about 7 years. It'll be 7 years this summer from Little Rock, so I feel a little bit like I'm at home, even though not exactly in my hometown. And it has been, honestly, a dream come true to work in such a large and vibrant congregation with the rich history that Temple Israel has, and also in a city where there are so many needs and so many roles that clergy people and people of faith in general can fill to try and mend it and make it more whole. So it's been a wonderful experience so far. And I do a wide variety of things at Temple. I don't work on one portfolio or another. I have worship, education, pastoral care, the works. And I do that work because I feel a very strong tie to my people, to Jewish learning, to the good that can come from that kind of learning and that kind of living, and have grown into this kind of work over many, many years of people helping me find my way there. And it's been wonderful so far.
Interesting. And a perfect background to discuss these topics. So as you know, it's election night in Memphis, Tennessee, this strange and complex and in many ways frightening presidential election for our country, and you have chosen the topic of extremism. Did you look ahead on the calendar and know it was election night?
Well, I have to be honest, this date was changed from a later date in March, and so I think when it was rescheduled to March 1st, neither Reverend Greer nor I noticed that that this would be the backdrop of this conversation.
Okay, Rabbi Bowman, is that then the definition of providence or irony?
I'm not sure if that's our topic tonight.
Well, our topic is extremism. Why did you pick this topic?
This idea came about because Broderick and I were sharing our thoughts and feelings a few months ago about the things that really concern us, take up space in our thoughts, and keep us up at night when we look at the world, especially with regard to our religious practice and our religious leadership. What I shared, though I didn't know it was going to come to this exact title, was my sense of sadness, my sense of loss, that the word religious is so often owned by those with the most extreme religious views in our public discourse. And my feeling that it's not reflective at all of the religious people that I know, but because it's so loud, because it's so strong, and used so skillfully as a weapon, that people who I think otherwise might consider themselves religious people sort of shy away from that area of thought and conversation.
Sure.
And so when we really examined that, extremism seemed like a good word because it on the one hand conjures up something that so often our media says happens really far away from us and from people very different from the people that you might meet on the street in Memphis. But actually, if we're honest with ourselves, it happens in front of our faces every day.
Right. Well, I certainly agree with you that religion in the best sense of the word has nothing to do with extremism. But before we get to the good examples and good religion, How would you define religious extremism, and can you give some examples?
Well, I decided to look it up and just to see how it was defined, you know, in the dictionary. And what was said was really, you know, something very simple, advocating extreme measures or views. And this is extremism in general, not only religious extremism, but any sort of extremism. And I found that I agreed with that, but when I consider it, I think the way that I identify it is when someone's views, whether they're political or they're religious or some combination of both, can only stand if they annihilate other people's experiences, other people's needs, other people's pains, then that's an extremist view. And so it has to do with how other people who are also made in the image of God can factor into one's worldview, how much room there is for alternate ways of living, alternate ways of thinking. And I find that when I put that definition to it, whose experience is wiped out because of one's worldview, it becomes a lot easier to tell the extremist views from others.
And in this context, and you are a rabbi and I am an Episcopal priest, you know, I come across so many people that associate extremism as a just ipso facto religious view or even a religious phenomenon. How do you, when we have scriptures, both of our traditions, that have violence within them, that have even fundamentalism within them, how do you disentangle all of that to find the better parts, so to speak, of our religious heritage?
The way that I do it, and I think the way that my tradition does it in its best form, is simply the acknowledgement that there are a plurality of voices within these scriptures, that there are violent voices and there are loving voices, both human and divine. And there are also competing rights. There are moments when you have to hold up two values and say, these are both good. And how do I make a decision between them? And when I try to weigh those, can my compassion outweigh my judgment and my harshness and my staunchness and my belief that, of course, I'm always right? So when I go through that process, I guess, as a student of religious texts, I find that disentangling begins with an acknowledgement that there is a tangle. It's not all in harmony. And so, and to be okay with that, because the world is that way. This is a complicated world. And I think if our religious texts are viewed only as presenting a world that's black and white, they're not very helpful in facing what it is we have to face on a daily basis.
I think that's very interesting. And also, anytime we're talking about a subject like this, a religious topic that's so complex, we always need to say, sort of lay our cards on the table and talk about where we come from and what our method is. And it's interesting, I'll never forget in seminary 15 years ago, reading an Anglican or Episcopal theologian say that Anglicans share more in common with Reformed Jews than many other traditions, including many Christian traditions. And the reason why is because we have a similar approach to Scripture, where we can acknowledge that the Scriptures themselves contain multiple voices, contradictory voices, paradox, tension. And it's in the middle of all that messiness that through debate and prayer and ultimately service, that we can discover God's voice. But it's a long and difficult and painful process. It seems that the it's the interpretation of Scripture that gets us in the most amount of trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is. And I think it's born of, well, it's hard to say exactly what it's born of, but I think part one of the sources is a fear that people are not up for looking at Scripture that way, that we're all only looking for simple answers, that we're all only looking for black or white answers. And the truth is that, you know, as children, we need those kinds of answers. But I don't meet that many adults who, when they're faced with one of those gray areas in life, are satisfied with the black or white answer because they're in the middle of it. So I guess I sustain hope that that the more that we teach from this perspective, the more these texts can become relevant, and the more people can say that they object to the way that they're used most commonly, you know, out in the world.
And speaking of that, how would you suggest that people of faith or people of goodwill, how they should resist extremism? Why is this important?
I think one of the reasons it's important is because religion is such an incredibly useful tool for mending the world. It has within it wisdom of these thousands of years, and so many people's hands on them, molding them so that they become this very useful tool. And if we allow, if we don't resist the texts and traditions being used in that way, then we lose out on all of the wisdom, all the goodness that is embedded within them as well. So in a way, I feel that if we don't resist it, if we don't look through our own religious eyes at these texts and stand by that, then we cede all of the good and cede the holy ground to people who would use it a different way.
When I listen to people struggle with this question about how to resist extremism and other forms of evil or cruelty in the world, I think that people often get stuck because they look at rather dramatic examples like a Martin Luther King Jr. who offers his own life and is a martyr, or they look at people who have a lot of power and therefore a lot of ability, we assume, to work for good. And sometimes I think we get stuck because we feel like our place and our voice is much more modest. What advice would you give to someone who is trying to figure out what to do and feels like they don't have much authority or much of ability to change things?
There is that famous story that we share about Elijah, the prophet, and his railing against those who were practicing idolatry. And then he flees, you know, at the end of that story. And he winds up on the top of this great mountain, and he sees, you know, there's an earthquake, and there's a fire, and there's a great wind, all these huge, loud, powerful forces around him. And the text is very, you know, it's beautifully clear and simple. God was not in the earthquake. God was not in the fire. Where is God at the end of that episode? It's still a small voice. And I think that that example is emblematic of how important it is for those of us who are not always exactly sure that we have the right answer all the time to say that loud and clear in a religious voice.
Yes.
That self-criticism and self-exploration and doubt and learning and being willing to be proven wrong, those aren't acts of weakness when it comes to religion. Those are acts of strength.
It would be so interesting to listen to you talk about the prophets' vision for a world free from extremism, but a more interesting question for us might be, what is Rabbi Katie Bowman's vision for a world free from extremism? If you could imagine anything and encourage us in our own lives to work for a world that is more peaceful, just, and loving, what's the vision you would hold up for us?
Don't you want to hear me quote the prophets instead? I ask myself that a lot because literally I'm waking up in the middle of the night so disheartened by the incredibly violent talk that I feel we're surrounded by at this moment. And not even so much just the people who are talking like that, but the thousands and thousands and millions of people who are listening to them. It causes a great deal of fear in me. So I ask myself sometimes when religion is such a huge part of that rhetoric, where does it actually fit? What is a world that is not free of religion but is free of religious and political extremism? What does that world look like? And I found one idea from a particular Jewish philosopher that I'd love to share. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to quote him because I think he says it so beautifully. This is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's the chief rabbi of England. at Great Britain, and his latest book is called Not in God's Name, and it's about religious violence and extremism, and this is what he says. He says, "Religion acquires influence when it relinquishes power. It is then that it takes its place, not among the rulers, but among the ruled, not in the palaces of power, but in the real lives of ordinary men and women, who become extraordinary when brushed by the wings of eternity. It becomes the voice of the voiceless, the conscience of the community, the perennial reminder that there are moral limits of power, and that the tasks of the state is to serve the people, not the people the state. That is why we remember prophets and continue to be inspired by them. Religion, as understood by Abraham and those who follow him, is at its best when it resists the temptation of politics and opts instead for influence. For what it tells us is that civilizations are not judged by their power, but by their concern for the powerless, not by wealth, but by how they treat the poor, not when they seek to become invulnerable, but when they care for the vulnerable. Religion is not the voice of those who sit on earthly thrones, but of those who, not seeking to wield power, are unafraid to criticize it when it corrupts those who hold it and diminish those it is held against." And what I think he's saying is religion in its best form is not used as a tool of domination. It's not used as a tool to create conformity and obedience, even though there are voices within our texts that view themselves as saying that. I think its greatest contribution to us in our modern world is in its healing power, in its guidance for us as we find the right road, and reminding us, as Jewish and Christian texts always do, that the right road can't be one where people are left behind. It can't be one where people are lying in our wake because we were moving so fast that we just couldn't worry about them, and that some amount of compromise is essential to us all getting there at the end.
What a perfect way to end. We're really inspired by your vision and very grateful, Rabbi Bowman, for your wise and encouraging words. May we learn to live them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Religious extremism doesn't happen overnight. Almost no one notices it's happening when it's happening, which makes conversations like the one just had with Rabbi Bowman all the more pertinent. So, sit down over a drink with someone of a different religious tradition, or no religious tradition at all, trusting that your encounter of the other will be transformative, and that a better, more peaceful world might be possible. And join us next month as we welcome our guest, the Reverend Janae Pitts Murdoch. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown in Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. Our Theology Live logo was designed by Andy Gill. We offer special thanks to our friends at Alchemy in Memphis and our guest, Rabbi Katie Bowman. Visit us online at 901theology.com and follow on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events.